Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this. It is the Infrequent Flying Podcast pilot episodes. I'm JB, and as always, I am joined by our three pilots. Duncan, how are you?
I am great, thanks, JB. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Now, have you been doing anything over this awful COVID period? Are you able to teach people to fly, or is everything on lockdown for the RAF as well as everyone else?
No, we kind of locked down until we got a little bit of a few things in place to make sure we were as safe as we can be. But because the aeroplane that I fly, the Prefect, is side-by-side seating, you're around about 30 centimetres at the very most away. So keeping 2 metres away was kind of tricky. So we had to put some things in place to mitigate that, which we did. But now we're fully back at them now. So back full-time flying lots. At least once or twice a day. So things are great.
Dunk, what was the fix? Was it putting a plastic bag over your head?
I've had a...
Clear one.
Two plastic bags. In case one breaks. There's a joke about that, isn't there? I don't think we should tell that joke.
No.
So, yes, I've had a plastic and a paper bag over the old head. Just two holes. Like, it's an old sandwich bag. And I've got two holes for the eyes and a little smiley face for the mouth.
Like those NFL fans when their team is losing.
Yeah. Absolutely nailed the RAF's response to COVID. Well done.
Excellent. On a serious note, though.
Plastic bag over the nose cone.
What do you do about all the breathing apparatus? I mean, I actually thought that would make it a little bit safer because you've got your nose and mouth covered if you want to.
Well, no, we don't, actually, in our little aeroplane. We have a boom mic. So we don't have an oxygen system, and therefore we don't have an oxygen mask. So, no, we don't have anything. I think, you know, as you go, you know, further up the aeroplane training system, then you end up with Texan, which has got an oxygen system, and then onto Hawk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So I guess it's a bit closer, and you're sat more than 2 meters away, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it becomes a little easier. But for us, the way that we're doing it is we are, to be serious for just one moment, is we're consolidating crews. So I have one student at the moment that's about to expand with the relaxing of the COVID measures to two students. But it's a great system. Some would say that the Air Force really should have bought into this a long time ago, you know, having a primary and secondary instructor. I'm being facetious. We've kind of always had that, but it seems to have gone away recently. But since we've had COVID and having that primary secondary instructor construct back again, it's worked really well. It's really good.
Dunk, just so I have visions of your poor young pupil sat there like, do you remember Airplane? When Ted Stryker's talking to people in the cockpit, in the down the back, and that bloke pours petrol all over himself and waiting to light it.
Yeah.
Is he sick of you yet, or are you two getting on like a house on fire?
Well, none taken. Thanks very much, Fodders. You see, that's one of those things that no one says to a station commander, is it? Oh, sir, you're bloody boring. as Parker says, did you say, yes, sir? Yes, sir, whatever you say, sir. Yes, I've lost a few, to be honest. There's been a couple of burnings and a hanging. But, you know, I've moved on to my my final student, and they seem okay at the moment, fairly stable.
Excellent. And then working around clockwise on my screen, we have Godders. Godders, how are you, mate?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. Yeah, I've clearly been keeping the country safe from my front room. Integrating aircraft onto carriers. I mean, actually, the Navy and the Air Force have done a bloody great job recently, because COVID hit just as they were putting some modifications onto Queen Elizabeth, but managed to get that done, you know, despite they had to do some serious stuff in order to get the workforce back in there. Mm. Got her out on time, all the crew, so just over, I think it was 800, got tested before they went on. They went into isolation beforehand, and Queen Elizabeth sailed off, and she's done a load of sea trials and passed them with flying colours. And only, I think it was last week or the week before, the F-35s from Marham went and did their carrier qualification on board. You probably saw a couple
yes,
of pics.
I did.
So despite COVID, we've been piling forward with that, which has been really good.
She seems to be flying through these sea trials.
Yeah, yeah, she's doing really well, actually. I think it helps that the crew are quite experienced now. They've been across the Atlantic a couple of times, and now they're going into the one where it's called OST, Operational Sea Trials, where they're doing their proper, are they safe to operate, fire drills, you know, that sort of stuff. The stuff that Dunk will remember about getting wood wedges out as if she's been holed below the waterline, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So emergency drills that gets the entire crew doing what they need to be doing. Although it is different in this ship, you know, there's a lot more automation. And then once she'd done that, they've got the jets on board, and then she's going back in a couple of more modifications, and then the American jets are coming over to do it with us towards the end of the year. Actually, so all going really well.
So the Marham jets, which landed on there, I thought they'd already been carrier qualified. Is this just an extension of what they were doing?
Yeah, so when they did some of that carrier qualification last year, you're correct. There were some of the Marham pilots went out to go and do that. But this time it was all of the guys, and 207 Squadron had done it a bit earlier in the year. So the OCU got carrier qualified, and now 617 have as well. So, apparently it's just like the simulator, and it's one of those things where they'd plussed up the amount of trips that they were going to do in order to qualify. But now they've whipped them back out again because, you know, it's pretty straightforward, and the guys are taking it to it like a duck to water.
Excellent. Yeah, now just back to COVID. These carriers can be rather tricky, can they not? With COVID, as our American friends have found out.
Yeah, that was a rough one, wasn't it? Theodore Roosevelt. You know, ultimately they had one sailor die on that from COVID. And I think I'm sure I saw in the paper the other day that of something like 4,000 sailors on board, 2,000 tested positive. I tell you what, if you know, the good thing to come from it was that the US Navy learned so many lessons from that individual incident, which then ended up protecting all the rest of their carriers and ships around the world in the way that they did stuff. And also, that was the reason that we ended up testing, you know, because this was reasonably early on in the COVID business as well, testing all of the sailors that were going on to Queen Elizabeth as well. So the Americans...
What did you test them for?
Reading, writing skills, you know, that sort of stuff. A few of them
most,
clearly.
Most sailors need... Well, never mind.
Yeah. Horrific that it happened in the way that it did for that particular carrier. But, you know, they've shared all the lessons out of it. And I think it's made everyone else, a lot safer because of it.
Yeah, and of course, the serious business of defence has to continue. You've still got to have boys in Typhoons ready to take off, and people at sea, you know, ready to do whatever they do there.
Yeah, and
Goddess, is it? We're getting a bit into a COVID episode, aren't we? But have we suffered any sort of COVID cases? We haven't had any on 57 Squadron, you know, in our little flying arena. But has there been anything happened on the QE2 or the
QE2?
Well, is that what you call it?
No.
Why not?
You're becoming all
the QE2 was a cruise liner.
So what do you call it?
The Queen Elizabeth
the Second.
You're like, do you now, have you started calling the boat the ship? And the
yes. Yeah, because the ship. We visit the heads. I go athwart ships in my house now.
Have you become, you know, very sensitive to that sort of comment, the QE2? The what?
No, only because the QE2 was a cruise ship, wasn't it?
Because it was Queen Elizabeth II.
It makes perfect sense to me.
HMS Queen Elizabeth.
Can I just say, there is one thing which I do find peculiar, is we call ships she, no problem with that. But what about when a ship's got a masculine name? So, for instance, she,
like
the Prince
Bernard.
Of Wales. Well, the Prince of Wales.
Or Bernard, yeah.
Or USS Winston Churchill is a she.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. It should be a he.
It's a good point, JB. Do you know what?
If we were in France, we'd talk about fairly strict grammatical rules for this, wouldn't there?
Yeah.
Well, talking about the French, we talk about, you know, I think most people call their aeroplanes a she as well. But I was walking along at Fairford one time and there was a French pilot who was flying a Thunderbolt, and he was sat there next to this massive Thunderbolt. And someone, I just walked past, as he asked the question, said, oh, she is beautiful. And this Frenchman kicked right off, said, a she, it is not a she, it is a fighting machine. It is not a she, it is a man's machine. It really flashed up large.
I mean, so he has a point.
It's national, you know, whether we
The Russians call their ships he's. All the Russian ships are he.
Are they?
Yeah.
See.
But sorry, to go back to the question, Godders, do we know of any sort of COVID cases that have then we've managed to contain and shut down, and then, you know, clearly we're still operating?
In my area, two of the sailors that they tested out, the 800 or so, tested positive, and they isolated those guys away from the rest of the crew. This was before they even got on.
Right.
And I think because of all the procedures that they've used, they've not had any outbreaks on any of the ships. And actually, in the sort of defense updates, you know, I've heard very, very little about, you know, it affecting defense at all. So I guess we're doing all right.
Mm. Now, last to pitch in. Porky, how are you? Been very quiet there and eating. Unbelievably eating.
But it wasn't very quiet. You could hear him eating all the way through.
Well, what are you eating,
Porky? Must have been having a boiled egg.
I just stuffed my entire dinner. Brilliant. Just because they're perfect. You know, done ravaging on. Really good. Thank you.
I heard you've started to stuff your face now because you've been drinking since 4 in the afternoon, and you've all of a sudden got the munchies. Which isn't strictly true, is it?
I did have a couple of beers. My display nav jabber popped over with a couple of beers. So, you know, it was too nice a day to not do that. But no, it wasn't a session at all, and I am, I promise.
Excellent. So I guess you've been up to nothing then, Porky, because you can't fly around and... Well, you could fly around in Spitfires, but, of course, there's much more to it than you just popping in into the cockpit. So how are you preparing to get back in the air?
Well, we are back in the air. So the CAA allowed... It's called SSAC, the two-seater Spitfire flying. They allowed SSA to recommence probably 2 weeks ago. So I got recurrent and flew my first, did 4 days, sort of Thursday through to Sunday, last Sunday, and did 16 passenger trips. So,
bloody hell.
Yeah, we're back up and running.
That's incredible.
Up and flying.
Well, first of all, that is very, very good to hear. Second of all, how long do you need to not be flying, not to be current? Because you said you had to get recurrent again.
Yeah, so you have to get recurrent. We need to do three landings in 90 days. You need to do a currency check, which is an annual thing. And there's 5 years of flying sort of similar type of aircraft in 18 months. So, yeah, just a sort of, you know, a days of a bit like the BBMF, to be honest, you know, a flying test with Duncan. Kind of equivalent, and then a bit of a quiz, bit of ground school, and then, you know, you're back in it, really.
Nice. Who do you do your checks with down there, Parsi?
Charlie Brown.
Oh, okay, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so he's got a few hours under his belt. I think he's got 12,000 hours now.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
That's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, he had to sign my logbook the other day, and he looked at my miserable 5,000 hours and turned his nose up.
Yeah.
God. What a show-off.
Yeah,
but he is ancient.
And how's the airfield down there, Parky? Is it rock hard now?
It's good, yeah. So I think because they've obviously had a lot of time where there was clearly no flying at all. So I don't know if it's the fact that, you know, aircraft haven't, because it's quite a small little grass strip down at Headcorn, but they haven't had the usual, when it's been softer, you know, April, May, of lots of flying, you know, very little. I think they've flattened out a few bumps, but it does seem to be remarkably pleasant. It's not, you know, not nearly as bumpy as I recall. It's nice. So that was good. And Duxford's always, you know, a lovely big grass strip.
And here's a nerdy question for you. So when it's hot and dry and the grass sort of dies off like it does, starts to yellow out. I mean, you know how it is in the fighters when you've got a bit of grass there, it slows you down quite nicely. Are you kind of, you know, like the golf ball on the golf course, sort of bouncing along, you know, and you just keep going? Is it, you know, does it make a shorter strip seem, a bit shorter even?
You know, it seems fine. I learned a very interesting fact at Sidwell. Somebody was telling me that there was, back in the day, there was a sort of standard RAF grass, you know, literally a grass seed. I don't know if it's a broader grass or something or other, that, you know, the RAF genuinely worked out. You got nice braking action on this, and it was just a good grass that they had. But, you know, I just think for sort of the length it is and everything, don't know, I've not noticed anything, you know, to be honest, you know, as long as you pop her down fairly near the beginning of the runway and, you know, your speed is good, it's ridiculous how well the Spitfire does stop. You know, the Griffins are a little bit longer, aren't they? But, you know, I think probably sort of almost halfway down, certainly two-thirds of the way down, I'm always turning off, you know, Headcorn's runway. And it's only, you know, 800 and a bit metres. It's not a long runway. And there wasn't much headwind either this weekend.
No, I bet. We've got all the windows in the house open at the moment to try and get some of the headwind in. The of interest, I know Dunk's read it. Parky, have you read Silver Spitfire by Tom Neill?
No, I haven't. No,
It's brilliant. I really enjoyed it, and so I read that in lockdown. And one of the and he's based running up to D-Day with the Americans down in the Headcorn area. It's one of the satellite fields for the US Army Air Force over here. I'm sure he talks about... You remember when I came down to see you, we went for a beer in the little village. I'm sure he talks about that little village around the corner.
Yeah, Smarden. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there's some amazing stories. The owner came over and he can remember... maybe it was his dad, but at one time a Lancaster landed at Headcorn because all shot up and a bit, you know, three engine sort of job. And it just sat at Headcorn. It must have been a very, very interesting landing to get a Lancaster into Headcorn. Anyway, the boys did it. It was broken, the Lanc, and it was all sort of just kind of waiting to be repaired. And one of the crew came down last year and, you know, was talking about it. He was the bomb aimer. And then I think it was the daughter of the pilot as well that came down. And then this owner's granddad said he also was a kid. They knew the coppers and they broke into the Lancaster as children and played in it. And I just think that's just brilliant. They literally had a toy at Lancaster, you know, until 2 weeks the RAF came and fixed the thing and then they flew it out there. But there's a picture of this Lancaster just sort of sat on the western edge of Headcorn. But, you know, just ridiculously cool stories.
So has anyone ever come across the documentary? I'm going to say, is the B-29 the one that dropped the atomic weapons? I always get confused.
Yes.
Has anyone ever
seen Enola Gay.
Enola Gay.
Has anyone ever seen the documentary where they find one in the Arctic Circle? It's a completely true documentary.
An atomic weapon or a B-29?
A B-29.
So, I haven't seen that, but that does sound like a belter.
Yeah, so it's
not... Is it in good nick?
It's really not a belter. It's absolutely tragic. Spoiler alert, I'm going to ruin the story for you, but I'm going to tell you anyway. So the story is a crew were flying over the Arctic. engine trouble or whatnot, something happens, but they have to land this B-29. And they land it, and it's in perfect condition. And because the Arctic is basically dry, it's either frozen or it's not exactly raining, the thing has stayed in perfect condition for a long time. So this collector decides he's going to go to the Arctic, recondition it in the summer with his team. He's going to spend his own money. He reckons it'll be worth something, and then fly it back and sell it. That is the plan. So they film it.
I know this story, JB.
It's awful.
I know you come to the punch and say, I thought it was a B-17, but it was a B-29.
It's a B-29. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
So they fly out with the whole crew. He's got this engineer who is flying in and out on this little two engine thing with all his parts. They've set up rigging. They're taking the engines off. They're reconditioning it. They're putting the engines back on, and it's actually they actually get it to fly. Well, I say they get it to fly. They get to flight condition. They make a taxiway. They are taxiing, and it goes over a bump. And as it goes over a bump, for some unknown reason, there is some diesel which spills over some communication equipment. And before you know it, the cockpit is on fire, and this thing is now sat on the runway waiting to go. There's smoke bellowing out, and in the end, the whole thing burns into nothing. And they spent like 6 months restoring this, flying parts in and out. The chief engineer died, basically, doing it. And, it's now still in the Arctic, but burnt to bits. It's a fascinating documentary, and very sad.
Blimey. Why do you think... I can't quite comprehend how they would have... I know you said diesel. I doubt it. Well, unless they were sort of had some sort of...
Diesel for a generator. I don't think it was for the actual plane.
I wonder why would they have had that in the car? We'll just put a cup of diesel up on the combing here, just in case we need to put it in the generator we've got down the back.
Maybe they properly bodged it. Are there any... I think there are. There is a flying B-29 in the world, isn't there?
I think there's probably a couple, is there not?
Is there?
I think there is.
Well, there might even be a Russian one. I say that. The Russians made a B-29. They reverse engineered it.
They were called Washingtons, weren't they, when we had them?
Oh, yeah.
We had them at Coningsby. So they were at Coningsby just after the war, Washingtons.
Have you ever seen the contraption that they used to fire the gun turret on the top of the B-29?
Is it a remote turret?
Yeah. It's unbelievable. If you think about what they were doing, they've got a computer in them. So if you look at a B-29, it's got these little glass domes, right? So the guy is looking around the glass dome and he fires. But the guns are like, I don't know, 10 metres back or however far they are. And they kind of rotate in line with this very, very basic computer that works off like valves and whatnot. It's incredible.
That's good. Who knew you were the world expert on B-29s, JB? That's good.
JB's the world expert on everything, Godders.
He would have devoured much more of the internet during lockdown.
Oh, yeah, lots of internet has been devoured, indeed.
Although, JB, have you, in terms of intros, have you moved jobs recently, did I hear?
I have. I have, after many, many happy years serving the people of Oldham with their financial services needs, I have moved to Beardmore & Co. So Beardmore & Co, independent financial advisors, which is where I now reside. So, if you need any of that bump, you can look me up there, Jonathan Beardmore, at Beardmore & Co. So that's actually my father's business, which he's had for quite some time. So very happy to be back there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
oh, good one.
Working with my brothers and my father. So very, very nice.
Family business established 1978.
No, 1997,
oh,
sadly.
Damn it.
But there's actually four of us working there, right? As in advisors, it's a bigger business than that. But it's my dad, my three brothers. So it really should be, do you like his law firms? It should be Beardmore, 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 and Beardmore. Really?
That sounds like a Monty Python sketch, doesn't
it? Welcome to Beardmore.
And is there, like some people invest in fine wines and that sort of stuff, are Warbirds good investment these days? I mean...
Well, because of course it's a regulated business, I have to start everything with this is not advice and whatnot. But no, Warbirds, I do not think Warbirds go into pensions anytime soon. Although I'd love to have a Warbird.
Are you thinking of buying one, Godders?
Well, I tell you what, I was at RAF Benson today. I had to go and do my annual training and break out the pistol and do me shooting, which was really good, actually. Really enjoyed it. But
did you fire it gangster style?
He's got negative. A bayonet on his.
Negative. Although I did have to. I'd not done it before.
Do you
I did
remember
have
Link
to...
Taylor off the back of the carriage? Remember that?
Maybe no, just... I wasn't there. I wasn't there.
So, okay, so it was a three squadron story. But you had to do your pistol training even when you were on the carrier. And but, of course, it's ridiculous. So they said, right, sirs, imagine there is a target to your front at 20 metres. They're off the back. They're on the quarter deck, just aiming out to sea. So it's ridiculous. They go, right, imagine there is a target there which you're going to shoot at. And anyway, cut a long story short, Link Taylor then just in a gangster style, he pops his pistol over the back and unloads the whole mag into the sea.
Duncan, I'm sure it must have been someone else, because Air Vice Marshal Taylor, I'm sure, would never have done anything like that.
No, it was definitely him.
Well, it was... we mentioned before, talking about off the back of ships, that they used to... we must have talked about bombing splash targets on the back, where they...
Yes.
Big length of rope, and they put a target in there. And it was, wasn't it Haskey on 3 Squadron? Haskey? When he was on exchange on the Sea Harrier, where he did a radar loft bomb on the splash target, and it missed. And this 14-kilogram practice bomb went through two decks of HMS Illustrious.
I think that was a high dive, mate. I think it was a high dive. That's what which I think, again, then, well, either one would be a 14 kg, wouldn't it? Sort of a slick replica weapon. And went, but someone lost his hand or something. It wasn't like
I didn't know that.
It wasn't a, you know, what an amusing incident. There was quite some injury that went on.
Sorry, just you need to fill in the gaps here. So, what did you say then, God? As you said, it was a toss. What on earth did you say?
Oh, yeah, it's a good point. So, I used to love this. When I did the F-16 training...
Parky zoned out now, by the way.
Well, no, Parky's listening, because he would have done this as well.
What's so you a do, bomb?
So you do... It's in the UK, we call it a toss manoeuvre, which is... So you're flying along at low level, you pull up. It was designed for...
It doesn't mean that it's just a very bad manoeuvre.
Is this what the Buccaneers used to do?
Yeah, but, you know, they had sort of guided missiles. This is for, like, a free-fall weapon, so it was designed for a nuclear delivery.
Yeah. The Bucs did it.
Where you would pull up to about, I don't know, above 30 degrees or so, and at a certain point you release your weapon. You then turn away, peel back, and run away as fast as you can in the opposite direction. And obviously this bomb continues, you know, apogees at some point and then comes down onto a target. So you can imagine a sighting system in some of the older aeroplanes, you know, prior to GPS weapons and that sort of thing, was pretty complex, actually, and really clever. And so, you know, so what we would do down the range is there'd be a radar reflector down there. So at a certain point when you could see it on the radar, you would lock to this radar reflector. You had an offset in, because as soon as you knew exactly where that radar reflector is, your kit now knows exactly where the target is, and you would get the information to be able to pull up, and it could either be an automatic release or a manual release on this one. And obviously, being Americans, I loved it. The the competition that we did for this loft bombing was called, you know, the winner was the Duke of Nuke, because it was a because it was a nuclear delivery. Suffice to say, I was not the Duke of Nuke. Because those things could flip and well go anywhere. But, you know, you only need a rough area when you're throwing a nuclear weapon off. But when we did it with little practice bombs, it was really good, actually. And if you got some, you know, close to the target on something that you're dropping a few miles away, you know, from low level, unguided, flipping brilliant.
So Duncan can answer this one. So what's a high dive then? Other than something that Tom Daly does.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, it's almost the same without the somersaulting.
It kind of is. It's a medium level delivery. So from whatever height, you know, normally let's say 20,000 feet, and you pull down into, again, normally a 30 degree dive, something like that. But it can be anything from, you know, anything 15 through to 45 degree angle of dive, which doesn't sound that much. You kind of think, well, you know, 90s where you think you'd be going. But when you're you've got 30 degrees or 40 degrees nose down, then it is quite a steep descent. So you then again use a targeting system and a way of targeting, whichever target you're looking at, to then deliver a slick bomb, so without any retardation, onto a target. And of course, because now it's got a lot of energy induced on it, it should have a lot more penetration than, you know, if you were to release a bomb which has to be retarded at, so have effectively a retardation system on the back of a bomb delivered from low level. So it doesn't frag the airplane that's dropping it.
Why would I want my bomb to slow down? Why would I want that sort of system rather than speed up?
Because the bomb will blow the aircraft up, JB. If you're delivering at low level, so you need it to
obviously
hang in the air for, you know, so that you can drop at low level.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you imagine, JB, if you drop a slick one at low level, it just flies in formation with you for a little bit.
And then it goes on.
And hits the target at the same time you get over the top of the target, so it frags itself. So at low level, we had, there were parachutes in little parachute retardation devices that would come out, slow the weapon down. I mean, again, you think that these could be hellish accurate. And the fact that you've got a parachute involved and all the mechanics in the aeroplane in terms of the weapon system and the sighting system, really clever to take into account all of that stuff so you could actually hit the target.
That's incredible. I never knew that. I wasn't sure at all why they did it.
The JB on a 1,000-pound bomb is enormous. So, for instance, we used to think it was 38-second splits. We did 38 seconds was the minimum that you needed to avoid the frag hemisphere of a bomb.
38 seconds?
38 seconds, yeah. And when you think you're traveling at 420 knots, you know, it's a long way away. You're a long way away at that point.
You're 5 miles away.
Yeah.
At that point.
So if you were, say, 4 miles away, there might be a possibility of you getting hit by something.
No! Someone coming through the target behind.
Sorry.
And then the medium altitude stuff is generally because of threats below you. So if there's a surface air-to-air missile system, some of the, you know, the older ones reach up to, you know, 10, 11, 12, 14, 15, 17,000 feet. So you'd plan your release based on the top level of that particular weapon system. Clearly, some of the huge SAMs, you know, and definitely the modern ones, that's why you end up with stealth fighters like F-35 to be able to get in amongst these spangly radars and the super high tech. But there's still a lot of low tech surface-to-air missiles, you know, dating back 5, 10, 20, 30 years around the world where, you know, you can be above some of the short-range stuff. So, you end up flying up there and releasing your weapons up there and planning it accordingly.
That's incredible. So, Parky, let me ask you this. How did you go about hunting these guys down with their retarded bombs and whatnot?
Well, I mean, I was air defence, so we would... I mean, typically, if we were doing affiliation training with Jags or Harriers, I was on the Phantom or Tornado, we would sort of try and shoot them or have the fight before they went into the range or before they did their sort of, you know, exact bombing bit. So gave them a chance to sort of regroup. But when I did my exchange on the F-16, it was a sort of multi-role. So it was 50 air defense, 50% mud moving. And I really enjoyed, especially the Goose Bays. You know, you could sort of, you had to do the sort of, I think, 14 trips out there at 100 foot in the 2 weeks.
Could you just explain where that is, Parky? I think we have...
Sorry, that's out in Canada. We use the low-flying system out there. But I remember you've probably done a fair bit of it, Doug, but there were little cardboard cutout sort of SAMs or tanks, you know, somewhere in this massive Canadian, you know, wilderness that you had to find and do a simulated delivery on. And I found it massively satisfying, actually, to try and, you know, you could do a system delivery, I seem to recall, in the F-16, but the far more accurate one at the time with the bombs we had was a manual delivery. You overrode it and then just, you know, literally put the continuous computer
CCIP,
put that through it. And, you know, when we went to the range, it was it was always a DH in the F-16. I'm sure it was in pretty much any fast jet. They were, you know, ridiculously accurate. But it was something that I was just really almost embarrassed to admit it as an air defender. But it was great fun, especially going to the range and dropping weapons. But you know,
but mate, when you were out in Goose Bay, because the reason that we generally detached out to Goose Bay was that we would practice what you'd call operational low flying, which is 100 feet flying, the whole of this wilderness area on the east coast of Canada, sort of northeastern coast up there, flying from Goose Bay, was a 100-foot flying area. Whereas in the UK, there used to be, I don't know if there still are, I think there still are some.
Yeah, but, I think 7 Tango and 14 Tango still around.
So that there are areas where you can, or you could go and fly operational low flying. I doubt very much anyone does it anymore, do they? But you could go and do that in there, but it was quite a small area. Whereas Canada, it was just this vast, vast swathe of wilderness that you could fly at 100 feet with a range system that the Parky's talking about. And the flying was just phenomenal. Flying at 100 feet, when you think, you know, a bog standard tree is about 100 feet tall, so you could be flying down a river,
yes,
a gully of a river, with the tops of trees whistling past you, you know, doing 420 knots. And it's just the most exhilarating thing. You'd have lakes out there which were absolutely mirror calm, and I remember those were actually the most dangerous things, because it was quite easy just to set up an insidious descent, and when you're flying at 100 feet, it only takes, well, you know, a second or two, and you know, you can end up being extremely low and extremely close to the terrain. So it was really, really concentrated the mind. It was fantastic flying.
Did we not share a video on our group of an F4 flying at 50 feet around the Falklands?
That wasn't Parky, was it? It
definitely wasn't Parky.
No.
It wasn't Parky, because...
Definitely not Parky.
I think, you know, I did, because...
dare you?
Bring into question my professionalism.
a friend of mine's father-in-law was flying F4s about the same time as Parky, and I know that you recognise the squadron. So we've definitely passed it around.
And I'm sure all of us could, you know, this is back in the day, but, you know, certainly with the Dutch, the video equipment and the head-up display that it recorded, it was really, really, you know, good quality. And the videos that the Dutch had kicking around, you know, I mean, it was a long, long time ago, 25 years ago. But, you know, I've seen F-16s with centerline tanks flying with 10 foot on the rad alt over lakes. And at times it went to 0 to 10 foot, 0, 10 foot, and that's with a centerline tank that's, you know, 6 foot. You know, it's ridiculous. It looks like, you know, you're in a car or go kart, to be honest. But you know, that sort of stuff did, you know, probably back in the day. And I've definitely seen some French videos of some amazing stuff out in the, you know, the desert. But you know what Dunk's saying, you know, if you're actually operating the aircraft, and you know, especially I'm sure it'll be the same in the Harrier, you know, to try and get yourself, fight your way past some sort of air defense threat, and then essentially you're probably having to kind of, you know, split, for want of a better word, you know, you notch, so you hit the beam, you then almost regroup, and then try and get your bombs on the target within a few seconds. You are working so hard in the F-16, obviously operating the radar as well. And I would say 100 foot is about, if you are working hard, you really don't want to be any lower than that.
And did you do all that stuff out there in the F-16 at 100 foot, Parky?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, because I just remember it. It'd be interesting to get your take on it, actually, because we... is a great, you know, skill to work up to. And as you say, high workload, but the tactics we'd use is we would, if we were a pair, we'd be 2 to 3 miles battle. So that would be line abreast formation, flying at 100 feet. And you would then, you'd only occasionally glimpse your wingman or your leader, whichever one it was. You'd see him just, you know, pop up probably once or twice every 15-20 seconds, so you knew that you were still in formation. You had an air-to-air TACAN, so you kind of knew he was still there. But I guess that made it pretty difficult for air defenders to find those sort of formations. If you had four ships, you'd have offset card. You'd have guys, you know, 30 seconds or a minute behind in wide battle as well. So four ships coming through, trying to saturate those air defense radars. How was it on the other side of the fence, Parky?
I mean, so long as you had velocity, i.e., you know, there was closure, because they're all looking, they're not looking in pulse, so they would just see the ground. You know, obviously a little Harrier at 100 foot, you would not see him with a pulse set. So you're looking at the Doppler shift, and, you know, all these clever radars, and the F-16 was you know, medium PRFs at a pulse repetition frequency. They were ridiculously clever, but you know, the Tornado and the Phantom were very good. You know, you'd see everybody if they were closing once. And, you know, we would tend not to try and give them a sniff or a lock, because with the radar warners,
yeah.
I remember the Harry.
Was it more difficult,
you had your Zeus pod, and
yeah, that's right.
You would be.
Was it more difficult, though, to see us at 100 feet than it was 250?
No, I think generally, you know, it's a Tornado and F-16. Once you've in track while scan, you know, you get the TD box, so you get the target designator box in your head-up display where you are. And you know, it's pretty accurate. So you're just looking at that, and sure enough, you know, it's very much sort of terrain dependent, isn't it, Dunk, and lighting levels and all stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, bizarrely at the time, you know, before I was a glass wearing idiot, I you could generally 7 or 8 miles, I would try and be tally on, you know, and pretty much get SA. And I knew, for example, you know, my mate, if it was me, it's a four ship, for example, and that's the front right guy. So I know where to look for the other three, if you like.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's just sorting into the fight, but again, if you're flaring, if you're notching, you're doing a good job. You know, it was just cracking, wasn't it? It was just a brilliant.
Do you remember as well there that I think we could carry flares in Goose Bay, couldn't we?
Yeah.
But if you were flaring below a certain level, I can't remember what it was, but the flares would bounce off the ground.
yeah.
You know, because they were still burning when they when.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
And they hit the ground. But one of the things, JB, I'm sure we've mentioned it before, but you know, you get pretty. I mean, Dunk's teaching the you know, the young pilots at the moment to do low level, and you just up the speed to when you're doing sort of 420, 480, you know, 500 plus. But it's when you drop the height. So 250 feet seems low the first time you ever do it, but you get so used to it, and then the first time you ever do 100 feet. You think, there is no way on God's earth I'm going to be able to operate down here, because it's all you can do to look out the front. It's like going at light speed in the Millennium Falcon, you know, with the stars going that way. But then the more comfortable you get at it, the easier it gets. To the point where, you know, when you do that first trip, there isn't, you think there is no way on God's earth that if I when I'm at low level like that, if I get attacked by someone, I can turn into them at that height. But, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 trips, whatever, you are turning and keeping your speed up at 100 feet. I'm sure there was a rule in there that we had to come up after half a turn, 180 degrees or something like
because
that.
Because you've lost your airspeed and you start falling.
Yeah, but you could continue those turns. You could continue fighting because actually down at 100 feet, as Parky's talking about radar seeing you and that sort of stuff, even the smallest, you know, even the best radar on the planet cannot see through a hill. And when you're down at that level, there's quite a lot of hills around the place. You know, even the smallest river valley gives you some sort of protection against those sorts of things. So it was flipping brilliant. And our mission planning systems would do this thing called intervisibility. So you could put the threat system in the computer on the map, the target that you're flying against, and you could set the level, that the height that you are flying. So, you know, if I put 1,000 feet in there, each radar system would have a sort of maximum range and it would be a solid fill. I, at 1,000 feet, all of those radars are going to see me. But as soon as I start dropping it, you'll start to see gaps in their radar coverage where they can't see through the terrain. And then, so when you're down at 100 feet, practically the whole thing is clear, you know, if, all right, in a desert, it's not, but in that sort of Canadian terrain. So you could find a way into targets, you know, just by this operational low flying, you know, amazingly. And in
it was 360s reversal and split, wasn't it, Goddess?
No, but you remember,
reversal and split.
Yeah, but that was always, the 2 360s was just general low level evasion. But yeah, when you're at 100 feet, I think you could do a 180 at 100, and then you had to come up to 250 to fight the rest.
Yeah, so, you might be right. I can't remember that.
So that rings a bell.
I just want to revisit something which Parky said. Which he said, and tell me if I've got this right. Did you have to memorize, I guess, the tactics or the formations that the attack aircraft would be in order to find out where they were? So he said, you know, I could spot the lead aircraft. I knew what the formation would be, so then I knew where to look for the others. Was that something that you were doing?
Well, it was from the air defence side of things, it's, you know, with the missiles that we had at the time, so, you know, we were talking sort of Sparrow Skyflash. Nowadays, the missiles are far, far better. It's still, if you go to the beam, so it's hard to describe, JB, but if you are flying at 90 degrees to me, there is no closure and you're down ridiculously low, so you are perfectly on a 90. I've got no closing velocity, my radar won't see you. Even some missiles will find it hard to shoot you down. So now you're probably into visual heat seeking missiles, you know, ASRAM or the Sidewinder it was back in the day. But it's probably now going to be a bit of a turning fight, so you can stick your nose into that fight. But, you know, even the Harrier would have had a Sidewinder on it, or, you know, Russian aircraft the same. So what you don't want to be doing is turning too much in the front guys if there's guys behind them, because they will take you out, etc. So you have to be very careful, and you do need SA, situational awareness, on what that formation is. You know, it's like the Top Gun thing when he thinks there's just a single turn and it turns out to be what, two of them kind of thing. You know, it's you want to know what's going on, and decent radars now will do that, and it's not difficult, but you know you need to know, are you shooting the right hand guy, the left hand guy, even beyond visual range, or certainly when you get into the merge.
So you've got to get low enough to basically see things because of the gaps in your radar coverage, or do I have that wrong?
Oh yeah, so you'd have sanctuary. So generally we'd have 1,000 foot buffer between, you know, if I was doing a 2v4 against Duncan, four Harriers, they would have 250 feet, you know, or 100 to 250 feet. And then the fighters would be 1,250 feet and above until they were tally. And that meant you could see everybody before you went below that sanctuary. And equally for them, they had to stay at low level before they could climb up and, you know, take a pot shot, because they were desperate to shoot down a Phantom or a Tornado. You know, that's cool for them. But so you always, and even today now, you know, in Red Flag, it's incredibly important that there's a sanctuary, so that if you do lose SA, you know, radar wise or whatever, you're not going to clap hands with the opposition.
Ah, has anyone, either of you Harrier boys, ever got a virtual kill on an air defender?
Yeah,
loads of times.
Never, loads of times.
The tactics are really interesting, and it was just the most fantastic flying. There's a, I don't know why I particularly remember. We'd go and fly a lot of the time in. It was called OTA Echo, Operational Training Airspace Echo, I think is what it was, yeah. Which was up in the northeast of England, up into the Scottish borders, and you'd press through with a four-ship of Harriers to hit a target just to the southeast of Edinburgh somewhere. You'd always get attacked by tornadoes. And on a beautiful day when they would press in, as Parky said, we had a system that allowed us to know that we were being targeted by an air defender. And if we were targeted, we would immediately try and turn to that notch that Parky's talking about. And it would then collapse into a visual fight. And you end up, as Goddess was saying, you have certain rules you have to stick to, but a turning fight with whether it be F3s or, you know, some of the foreign guys came over in F16s and came and fought for training as well. So it was just the most, it was great when you're a young lad in most fantastic swept up fighter jet and you're training, you know, fighting other fighters. It's just brilliant.
Yeah.
And Doug's right when he said, OTA Echo in the UK, second tour I did in Germany, and it's a very similar system. It's changed a bit, but the whole low flying, they had massive great areas where you're allowed to do 250 feet in Germany. Not quite so good in Holland and Belgium, but it was pretty cool. But in Germany, you know, it's certainly normally you would know who you are. You know, you see, you'd pre-brief against the Harriers or the Jags or Tornado Boys, and you'd go through and a Phil performer, and you'd essentially know who you're up against and you'd, what time, you know, we'd be ready for them. They'd fight their way through. But often in Germany, we wouldn't bother pre-briefing any of Phil because it was so busy. And you guys probably heard there's it was the low-flying area one with the Pihai mask up in sort of the north German area up there. And you could just spend an hour fighting and there would be visual furballs of F-16s and Starfighters and some Brit Harriers and some, you know, it was just there's some Mirages coming through and you would land and you'd have seen seven or eight different types of, you know, fighter and formation. And it was just, it just immense fun. It really was extraordinary.
What a lovely trip down memory lane.
It's good. And JB, you know, you mentioned it as well, the sort of formation that the attackers are flying in. And so I think it was Parky mentioned the term battle. Now, battle is a particular type of formation that is, it came from the Second World War. Actually, the Germans who came up with this Luftwaffe in the Spanish Civil War and then brought it into the Second World War, where rather than where the Brits started in the Battle of Britain, you know, a sort of finger four close in formation, follow your leader around, the essentially the thing that's in Top Gun, actually, we never flew like that. You'd fly at least a very minimum a mile apart, probably more.
Wow.
Because when you look out the window, you can look across at your wingman. He's doing the same for you, and you're giving each other cross cover for either air defense aircraft or any other aircraft coming in at you or ground fire coming up at you as well. So, you know, it gives you the very best of lookout. And someone mentioned card formation there as well.
Yeah, card. Card, I think you said. Was it Duncan?
Yeah, card. So that's, you know, so just like a four of clubs or something like that, the way the clubs are spaced on the card, you have two at the front, two at the back. So you might have, I don't know, 30 seconds to a minute between them. But that was the thing for the, you know, clearly I've done both as well. You know, if you're pitching in on a formation down at low level, you need to know where everyone is because you can pull in behind someone and then get shot by the people you didn't see behind you. So, you know, there was all sorts of games and in terms of what formations that you flew and how you did it, stinger, chair, ladder, you know, all these sorts of things. And they're called certain things because from an air defense perspective, when you're describing, it's called the picture. So when you describe the picture that you see, you have to have terms that mean the same to everyone. So there's a full NATO standard of you see a bunch of blobs in a particular shape on the radar. You'll say, you know, finger, you'll say, you know, box four, and give a bullseye position. And a bullseye position just means that you've got an anchor point on the ground and it is a range and bearing from it. And you give an altitude as well. You know, so there's a particular way of saying things on the radio so that people understand what the formation is out there. So if you end up attacking them, you know you're not going in blind, even if you can't see them all.
Incredible. Incredible. So I've thought of a very basic scenario there, which is, you know, attacking planes, sorry, ground attack aircraft, and then obviously Porgy hunting people down. But I assume if you were planning a mission yourself, you'd probably have your ground attack aircraft and then someone above the ground attack aircraft looking after them, i.e. some sort of air defender of your own. So then Parky's got to navigate the air defenders on top of him whilst hunting you down.
Yeah, so you have the sort of escort or sweep and they can be embedded. Generally, they sort of a couple of minutes ahead, I'd say, got us. You just sort of sweep the area. And you've obviously, you know, got comms and you can maybe, you know, tell the bomber force to, you know, sneak up the left-hand side, if you like, while you try and distract
a lean left bit.
But it really is a sort of, you know, a cat and mouse and you know, war gaming, and definitely Frighty. You know, tacticians, just as they were back in the day, you know, World War II, you had the good guys who were just naturally, you know, more adept at it. It was you know, that was one of the skills that you picked up, and you know, it, building what God has mentioned, building that picture and having that sort of understanding, three-dimensional as well, as to where people are. That's the stuff that could really make you, you know, be working hard.
And it was the same on the ground, you know, when you were doing the ground attack, having that picture. And we were pretty severely disadvantaged in the Harrier because we had no radar. So you would be listening to the picture that would be being given either by a ground control intercept radar. So you have a guy with a massive radar that's just looking at the whole picture, and he's telling you where the threats are, and therefore you would try and step round these threats as the ground the ground attack guy is trying to get to your target. But equally, we used to call them CAMEOs, so combined air operations, where to practice this very thing, you would get huge numbers of aeroplanes, and you would have ground attack aircraft. You'd have fighters that were escorting the ground attacks, and then you'd have the Red Force fighters that would be trying to shoot them down. So the thing that we were talking about initially with Parky saying, "Yeah, I could see, you know, that formation coming in towards me," just to throw the cat amongst the pigeons, you know, that fighter escort would try and bomb burst those Red Force fighters, so that they had to reset and try and reacquire the picture to try and shoot down those ground attack aircraft that were trying to get to their target.
So what's bomb burst? Is that just making them disperse?
Yeah, just to try and get them to react to their own missile systems. So the Blue Force, let's call it Blue and Red, the Blue Force missile systems, they were, of course, susceptible to those. So they would have to react to either run away, which Parky was excellent at, I heard, very good at turning tail and staying well behind the lines. But they would
Doug was generally on the ground because he went US. His aircraft was broken. But
he's
seen a couple of the videos of the boys doing it.
You would then have to, as that Red Force air defense element, they'd have to then recommit and of course, have regain that situational awareness that both Parky and Goddard were talking about earlier. So it's actually enormously complex, fantastic to be part
Isn't
of
it?
And sort of develop those skill sets.
I'm imagining
JB, if I give you a picture call, see if you can work out what it is. Parky will be salivating at this one, but if I you know, Viper picture, two groups, range 10, lead group azimuth 5, 15,000 bogey, trail group 22,000 hostile. That right there, Parky knows exactly what we're talking about. So where the bullseye position on the ground is.
Okay.
So it'll be anchored on the ground somewhere. And that'll be the same for everyone on your side fighting in that particular fight. So whatever I said, if I said 260-10, so from that position, 260, so just south of west by 10 miles is where the groups start. And I've said two groups range 10. So there's a group at the front that's more than one aeroplane, and that's at 16,000 feet. There's a group at the back 10 miles away. They're at 22,000 feet. And I said azimuth 5 as well. So these are 5 miles spread of each other. So you've got that sort of, you know, four of spades kind of picture in your head. So even without seeing that on my radar, I know exactly where they are, and I know exactly what formation they're in. But
and
you can imagine
And you've also put in there front groups bogey and rear groups hostile as well. So
Exactly. So we haven't quite identified the front group, so we don't know definitively that they're hostile, whereas the rear groups are hostile. So if I get my radar on and I can confirm that it's those ones that we're talking about, then I can shoot them.
Ah, so bogey is neither hostile nor friendly.
Correct.
Yeah,
never knew that.
Bogey's unknown, yeah.
I always thought that so in films, two bogeys, wherever, that means that, you know, that means shit is going down.
Yeah, generally. If someone calls a bogey, you know, you've got to visually identify it before you can shoot it if it happens to be hostile.
That's incredible.
So you can see from there, right? So that picture, nice clean picture, and as any of us will tell you, I mean, it's like, you know, your rugby podcasts, the pitch is nice and clean. You know, you go for that kickoff, everyone's in formation, but as soon as someone catches it and that first ruck forms, all bets are off. You know, try and explain that to someone. And that's exactly what happens. So as soon as someone engages, or they do the bomb burst or the exploding watermelon, as Dunk talked about, and these people disappear, change heights, do all sorts of stuff, now that picture becomes really complicated. And in the current day, you know, in modern day, it is so much easier because you've got data links that are, you know, fed into your aircraft from other aircraft that you're feeding to other aircraft. So generally, even when your radar isn't on, you're seeing a picture on the display.
So you could,
and you've got a helmet mounted sight. So when you turn around the corner or look around the corner, you can see little designator boxes around the place with all of these people in.
Yeah, of course. So I'm just thinking now, you could do, you know, if you're in your Typhoon Goddess, you could be doing a sweep in the wrong area on purpose. So Parky rushes over there to fire some stuff at you whilst Dunk goes 20 miles down the road or whatever it is. And
exactly. See, you'd make a good fire pilot, JB.
Sneaky. Unless he doesn't bite, and then all bets are off.
Yeah, so you can imagine, can't you, that the intelligence that you have on the other side is really important. You know, understanding the sorts of tactics they employ. Because, and again, this is exactly like sports. You know, what tactic are the other team going to employ? So how would you defend against it?
I mean, to the degree, you might want to know, you know, how each different squadron behaves. You might have certain characteristics just from the squadron.
Yep, exactly. And
you look back at World War II, then certainly different squadrons had, you know, reputations, didn't they? The Polish squadrons, for instance, had a reputation for being particularly aggressive fighters. They did. And I guess if something kicked off like that again, then again, squadrons would have that reputation if they could get through and hit targets, or if they were, you know, shooting enemy aircraft down in abundance.
That's fascinating, and also has nothing to do whatsoever with the topic that we decided that we were going to talk about an hour and 12 minutes ago.
How long it's been? God, I tell you what, I've enjoyed this trip down memory lane.
It's been a good one. I wish we should do some questions though, eh, Godders?
Let's do some questions.
Yeah, well, we've got a few, actually.
Go on then, smash us with the first one.
No, Parky was going to say something.
Was he?
No, I said...
I think he'd finished.
Sounds like he's keeping his tactics very close to his vest there.
Right, here we go. Here's some questions then to finish off. God, honestly, that felt like we've been going for 2 minutes. How long have we been going for?
1 hour, 12 minutes, boys.
I'm sorry, everyone, because there's no commutes at the moment, aren't they? Are there? So people are just bored in their houses. Yeah. Right, this is from Brian N., Brian Kentman. What's your favourite civilian airfield? There's a question.
That's a good question.
I'm going to go first before anyone else gets in there. But for me, it's got to be White Waltham. I love White Waltham.
Oh, yes.
Why?
Like it.
It's a beautiful old, still a grass airfield. It's got an Art Deco clubhouse that was used during the war. It was the main operating base for the Air Transport Auxiliary. So although it wasn't an actual operational fighter base, it had these incredible people, boys and girls, that flew all different types, whether they be bombers, fighters. They were just given a set of notes and told to deliver these aeroplanes off to the squadrons. So that in itself is a fantastic history. But we spent quite a lot of time there, and we ended up, there's one particular one that sticks in the mind, where we'd done this huge fly past for the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Britain, and we were supposed to be going into Northolt. Cut a long story short, the weather
we got past, the weather was fine, and we were battling through some miserable weather, eh, Parky? You'll remember this one.
It was a bit rainy.
It was a bit rainy. So there were six of us fighters. So I was leading six fighters, just having done these big fly pasts. And we'd come past White Waltham, and I'd seen that it was clear. So effectively, it was my banker. I had it in the back pocket, and we had to turn round because there was so much rain and low cloud around. We pitched back to White Waltham, and luckily, someone was still in the tower. Everything, I mean, it was getting towards sunset, wasn't it, Parko? And and so we ended up then calling up on the radio and saying, hey, listen, we've got to divert somewhere. Are you happy for us to land with you? And they said, we'd be delighted. So we put them all down at onto the airfield, and they were quite happy for us to line all these fighters up outside this old Art Deco clubhouse. And then, God bless them, as we got out, they bought us all a beer. So it's got a certain special place in my heart.
What were you flying?
Well, I was flying the Mark II Spitfire. Can't remember what you were in, Parky, but we had four Spits, two Hurricanes, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful picture here. I've just looked it up, and it's a beautiful picture here of White Waltham with a blue Spitfire in it, which looks very, very nice indeed.
Yeah, it's a great place.
Yeah. What about you, Parky?
Headcorn would be too obvious. So I think I can remember North Weald we went to quite a few times, and it's still got Battle of Britain revetments there, which are just amazing because Aero Legends have moved in there, and we had a look around. So that's where you get two Spitfires in the revetment, and all the ground crew and the pilots could sort of sit in the back of the U-shaped revetment. And it's just fantastic. It's you know, like a time warp. So when you get to North Weald, we'll go and have a look at those places. And I can remember one, just of a little story, very quick, was, I don't know if you were the boss, Doug, it was when Johnny Stringer was the stage, and that I was going to be doing Westminster, but the weather was just looking really like 35 mile an hour winds, and Westminster mid-September was not going to happen on the Battle of Britain flypast, you know, for the few as well. So I remember just phoning the Met Man just for a final check that it was going to be by 1 o'clock local. The weather was going to be ridiculously windy. And he went, well, yeah, I mean, it will be at Coningsby. And then obviously it'll be sort of by 2 o'clock, it'll be very windy down south. So at 1 o'clock, will London still be okay? Yes, it will. And the short of it, I phoned the stage. It was a goer, so maybe it was you, Dunk. And it was back on. And I got Johnny in and we took off. We did, you know, just before it got wet, we pre-deployed to White Waltham. You're airborne from White Waltham. North Weald. Well, you're about the same, actually. From White Waltham, you can see London. But from North Weald, once you're airborne, you can just see London. It's so close. And we did the flypast, a spit in a hurry over Westminster, which was brilliant, back into North Weald just as the winds were really picking up. They put our spit in a hurry in a hangar, moved some other aircraft out, which were going to get really blown away. And then we had a beer as well, and then got picked up by the ground crew from Goodwood and drove home. And it was just a fantastic, you know, just we managed to get it in, that feeling, you know, especially, you know, those Westminsters were very, very treasured because they didn't come around that often. And, you know, it was obviously a massive honour to do it when the boys were still around, which they were, you know, a few years ago. But North Weald's lovely, a really so close to London and a great little airfield. So,
there's also a theme there as well, isn't there, that we both got given a beer now at the end of it. I'm sure that's probably got something to do with it.
Funnily enough, I mean, I can't really go for Kenley, which is where I grew up and, you know, gave me the sort of love of aviation, which is a Battle of Britain airfield, because I've never landed there. But I think, and it's based on a story, just like both of your favourite airfields there, I think it's Goodwood. Where I went to the revival, I landed. It was pretty late at night. Late in the evening. I was in the Silver Spitfire. Land and you know, you can, JB, you can see why these things are called Spitfires when you're landing in the dusk, because all you can see is the bloody flame that's coming out of the exhaust in front of you. So landed at Goodwood, and you know, I subsequently checked my logbook, and I'd first landed there in July 1989 on my first solo cross country when I was doing my private pilot's license. And then the very next time I land there, I'm in a Spitfire, which is flipping amazing to me. And it's got Battle of Britain heritage as well. But it was incredible because I taxied around, never been there before, taxied into, could see Parky and another guy, Smithy, standing there waiting for me. And you remember Parky, they do it every year, but they built the revetments, you know, the sort of Second World War stuff. So you guys were in, a Hurricane and a Spit. There was a P-47 there and a couple of Mustangs, I think, you know, so parked up and the whole place is done up. The revival they've got, everyone is dressed in the sort of Second World War gear. It's pretty late at night. And as soon as I get out the aeroplane, the ground crew there turn it around. Parky hands me a bottle of Spitfire beer,
obviously,
which just tasted flipping amazing, you know, when you've just stepped out of a Spitfire. And then I remember you two guys, especially being petrol heads, went, come and have a look at this. It took me about, 30 feet around the corner, and there was this paddock there with 10 Ferrari GTOs. Do you remember that park?
10?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, so each one of those Ferrari GTOs, minimum 25 million quid.
Yeah, I was going to say, 10's quite a lot. Yeah.
So, you know, you've got a quarter of a billion pounds worth of car and some, because, you know, all of the rest of Goodwood is covered in these amazing cars for the revival.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. I thought Goodwood was a racetrack, not a...
Yeah, airfield. So there is a racetrack that runs around the airfield, you know. So subsequently in the weekend, we flew quite a lot. I don't know whether you remember that particular one, Parky, but we flew quite a lot. And on the final, on the Sunday, I took off to go meet up with a Hurricane to do a fly pass for the Battle of Britain over Westminster.
Right. Yeah, I remember.
Millie was in the Hurricane and it went US. So I ended up on my own at the most amazing day. You know, every time I tell this story, I talk about the fact that you could see the back of your head as soon as you got airborne. And from the hold, I could see all the parts of London that I needed to, straight past the eye, over the top of Westminster Abbey, where, you know, some of the old boys remaining down there, and then asked for a depart out of across Wimbledon, over the top of Centre Court. Wimbledon wasn't running at the time. And then back down to Goodwood. When I landed at Goodwood, they were just finishing a race. And the weirdest thing, it was on the short runway there. They've got a big old jumbotron, this massive screen. And if you glance over to it, you know, the camera pans to you flying this aeroplane. There's you coming in to land. And you can see yourself coming in to land on this massive screen.
Yeah. Just that sounds an amazing awesome. I need to go to Goodwood. Goodwood sounds absolutely incredible.
Everyone needs to go there.
It's just the most amazing event, isn't it? But just those three stories, we've been lucky boys, haven't we? I mean, what a fantastic time.
I tell you what, I'd rather be lucky than good. Right, yeah. So here's we've got tons of questions. We're going to have to do these again at some point. But
just before
go on,
continue,
JB.
White Waltham. Is there anything else that goes on there? Because I've got pictures of it here with a concrete runway. Is that wrong? Is there another one?
No, it's grass now. Back in the day, it may have been, but it's got
it's all grass now.
So they have a fairy gannet there, XA459.
Yeah, it's in a pretty sorry state though.
Oh.
It was last time I was there. It was just parked behind the hangar.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it's in an awful state. God, I would love to own that thing.
Wait, if you offer him a tenner.
Right, here we go. Next question. So this is from Matt Wright at Maffey587. This is a good one. I like this one. I've got so many stories about this. We could probably do an entire episode on this. So let's just keep this short. But has anyone really, in capital letters, needed a wee whilst flying? And what was the outcome? Quickest taxi and shutdown at Coningsby ever? Well, you don't actually need to taxi and shut down, do you?
I have never weed in an aeroplane.
What?
I have never weed in an aeroplane. I have
never been in
a sortie
long enough.
I have. Oh, my goodness. I did a sortie in Afghanistan that was 6 hours long. And when I landed, I had to just wee at the back of the aeroplane. I had to reverse my rudder pedal inputs because I'd crossed my legs over to the other side. I was so desperate to go to the loo. But there have been numerous times where I have just, you know, I've literally just had to get out the aeroplane and go, right, sorry, everyone.
So have you got a phobia about weeing in the aeroplane? And for the listeners, there is a procedure for weighing in the aeroplane because you carry a thing called a pea bag or a piddle pack, as the Americans call it. Just to explain, that is a small plastic bag that either has the old ones had a sponge in, and the new ones have a gel in that solidifies whatever you put in there. But it is the hardest thing to break the seal and go. And as everyone knows, once you've broken that seal, you ain't stopping. And on several occasions, I've thought this bag's going to overflow.
Well, I've got a story. I'm sure I've told this before, but I'm going to tell you again. Because I was out in Afghanistan. I was paired up with a friend of mine called Christian Ward. God rest his soul. But he is no longer with us, sadly. But we were paired up. We were going off. We're doing a night mission up to the northeast of the country. And we got airborne. We'd only been airborne about 15 minutes, quite a long transit, about a three quarters of an hour transit to get up there, meet a tanker, and then carry on. Anyway, so his nickname was Mental Ward. So Mental gets on the radio. He says, "Dunk, I'm going to be off the radio for 5 minutes. I need a wee." I went, "All right." So 5 minutes later, I'm back up. I said, "All right." He said, "There's piss everywhere." I was like, okay. So once I'd finished laughing, we then had to go and do like a 3 or 4 hour mission, and we came back for the weeing debrief. I'm like, "What happened, mate?" And he said, "Right, well, he'd never used one before, and he'd said to the safety equipment guys, 'Right, how do these work?' And what they'd said to him, so as God has said, it's like a bag with a sponge in it, with a neck, like a balloon, I suppose. Anyway, the safety equipment guy had said, 'Well, sir, what you do is you just blow into the bag to blow it up, and then you put it on the end of the old fella, and off you go.' So of course he'd taken this as read, and of course once there's air in the bag, there's nothing else going in there. So he'd unstrapped in this Harrier. We can't have been in goombags, but we'd unstrapped from this Harrier, you know, up at 20,000 feet on this transit, blown into the bag to blow it up, and then tried to go. And of course, nothing was ever going to go into the bag. So it just ended up being all over the cockpit.
Like I said, you know, there are some interesting stories around. Well, I've got a couple, but the one I'll tell was, so it was post 9/11. And I may have told this one before, actually. It's post 9/11, and we were doing quite long missions from the base that I was at, Shore. We were doing combat air patrols over Washington, D.C. You know, really interesting seeing, you know, you see the Pentagon, you can see everything that was going on. You'd go and refuel over Baltimore. And so you'd end up doing sort of 4 or 5 hour missions. And the Americans were brilliant. You know, for whatever reason, they stayed uber hydrated all of the time, you know. So there'd be guys filling up piddle packs before they'd even left the runway. You know, they'd be filling them up in the end of runway check, the EOR. But, you know, I was like, "You don't, you know, it's I never particularly liked it because you have to make your seat safe, you know, or put your pin in, and then you're unstrapping in the airplane. It's just unnerves me being unstrapped in a fast jet, you know, doing just slightly subsonic and not being, I mean, it's ridiculous really, isn't it? As if that's going to save you. But, you know, you're at least attached to your parachute if something goes wrong. Anyway, so I'm in this one, and it was absolutely fantastic. In fact, this could have been the Thanksgiving day that I flew on. And George Bush Jr. is giving a speech in the Rose Garden. I think it was the French president or I can't remember. There was some big thing going on the ground. And I thought, flipping out, I can't hold this any longer. So, you know, did everything I needed to, got the pedal pack out, put the autopilot on in terms of, you know, altitude hold. Told the other guy, there's a code word for it. I told the other guy that, you know, that's what I was doing. Anyway, did my business and, you know, sort of unstrapped, done all that sort of stuff. And I was about three quarters of the way through and I thought, hang on, something's not right. I looked out the window and I could tell all of a sudden that the nose of this F-16 was about 40 degrees nose up. I thought, oh my God. And at that moment, and Park, you'll remember it, there was the low speed warning horn, which means your aeroplane is about to depart. And what I'd done in terms of, you know, getting undressed and unzipped and everything was knock the throttle with my elbow. So the aeroplane had tried to hold an altitude, but we'd got slower and slower.
Was it your elbow?
And, And I'd got to the point, and I mean, clearly I rescued her. I had to put her into afterburner, you know, in order to get away with this.
And I had told the story, Goddess. It's brilliant.
I had nightmares, absolute nightmares later on of, you know, had this gone bad and I'd ended up departing the aeroplane over the top of the Rose Garden. You know, the press, the first thing they would have seen is this pea bag exploding.
The subsequent board of inquiry found.
Exploding next to George Bush, the President of the United States. And then me coming down on a parachute with my zip open, landing on his shoulders in some sort of hot shots press conference.
Excellent. Boys, I think I was going to say, I think you've excelled yourself. I've learned a lot this evening, and it's very enjoyable.
We've got so many other questions. I'll tell you what, next week or the week after, should we do a podcast dedicated to all the questions that came in tonight?
Yeah, we should really.
We were too busy banging on about memory lane, weren't we?
No, exactly.
Very, very good, boys. Well done indeed. Right, you can find us on Twitter, which is?
At Pilot Episodes Podcast.
And you can find you two boys at?
Goddess Twit.
And?
At Doug Major 222.
I'm at J Beardmore, and I don't think Lego Parky's still about, is he?
Yeah, Lego Parky's still around.
Oh, that's all right. Thank God for that.
I don't want to tempt fate here, JB, but the recording quality sounds like it's been pretty good tonight.
I've changed my computer. It's the computer's fault.
People will not be happy.
I think
they like the TDK C90 audio quality, don't they?
I tell you,
you wind it with the pencil.
When I'm recording, so just pulling back the curtains a bit now, not that anyone cares, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I usually record my other podcast, Egg Chasers. I'm all in the same room, and it's fine. It's fantastic. For whatever reason it is, when I recorded on my other laptop, it kept on cutting out, as we found out. But this one just runs straight through, which means I can do all my Rugby Dungeon interviews all over again. So, yeah, it's fantastic.
Well, it's only taken us, how long have we been doing these? About 2 or 3 years?
2 years or whatever.
2 years?
These ones, 2 years. Egg Chasers, but might be 7 years on Egg Chasers now.
Blimey.
Definitely.
2 years. But in those 2 years, we've only done 3 podcasts.
Yeah, so. We're not the most prolific, are we? But our quality is high.
Can you imagine how good the next one's going to be? Because 80 years ago today, what sort of stuff was happening?
Oh, good call.
Oh, I'm trying to think what day it is. What day is it?
Bad things were happening, I'm guessing.
Well, we're getting towards June, July, August, which is the height of the Battle of Britain. So I reckon we can have a good natter at the next one.
We're still in the channel at the moment, weren't we? The fight was there.
Yeah.
It's about to start on the airfields, I think.
Mm. Parky, are there any flypasts or anything planned for the 80th?
Well, yeah, no, nothing that's, you know, obviously we don't fly over London anyway. But I think there's going to be a Headcorn air show, and I think there's going to be a big Duxford, you know, COVID dependent, but that's the kind of plan. And I mean, something's got to be done, hasn't it, for the 80th? I mean, wow, what a big event.
Yes, quite right. We will reconvene soon, so thank you everyone for listening, and from me Doug, Godders and Parky, goodbye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.